This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 3. Before we go into the subject today, we have with us again Ralph Poynter to discuss the case of Lynn Stewart, and today in particular, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, this weekend having been his birthday. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Maya. It's nice to hear from you. I'd like to report on my weekly visit with Lynn, but I cannot because I did not make the visit because she had suggested that it was most important that I attend the events in Washington, D.C., presenting to the Obama Justice Department petitions to open the case of Mumia under the civil rights laws, as you know, and you're going to discuss how the injustices of 30 years ago or the injustices of America that were addressed by the civil rights movement are now being, what would we say, being moved around the world by Mr. Obama, these total injustices. And we were hoping to convince Holder and Mr. Obama to review Mumia Abu-Jamal's unjust convictions, but it seems hopeless, but we must keep working at it, and while he is spreading terror to the rest of the world in the same fashion that we suffered, and say we, I'm thinking of black people, and I'm thinking the irony of this so-called black man who had the hopes of so many people and the desires and the wishes that he would understand these injustices and support an end to them here, but we see that he's carrying it to the rest of the world, and Lynn feels extremely concerned about this direction, and I feel I would be remiss if I didn't speak on that. We're trying to make up the missed visit with phone calls because her suspension of 90 days for her cellmate having made a phone call concerning her medical condition ended a week ago.
Ralph, so, I understand that even though she's allowed phone calls, there's a time limit.
10 minutes a day. And for those 90 days, she could not call her attorneys. We're still asking people to get involved and try to understand her case and the injustices, the selective prosecution. Lynn is giving us hope. I feel bad out here, but when I see her smiling face and listen to her on the phone, I say, well, we can do this. We must turn the internal and external policies of America around.
As I recall, years ago, you and others went to the Justice Department also to ask for the opening of the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yes, and it seems that we're getting the same response now that we got years ago. So you see, the policies have continued with Obama, and it is a painful, painful, painful reminder of what we have here today in the Obama Holder Justice.
Well, you know, Ralph, when we were together in the Justice Department with respect to Mumia, and we were meeting with members of the Justice Department and Assistant Deputy Attorneys General and presenting to them the evidence that the people involved in prosecuting Mumia Abu-Jamal, in fact, those who had actually called for the death penalty, one of them became the governor of Pennsylvania, and the other the chairperson of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, who was then presiding over the appeal before them, and he refused to recuse himself. Just as Justice Sachs would not recuse himself from the Second Circuit, although he was the partner of Judge Mukasey, who had sentenced the man that Lynn was defending to life plus 100 years.
You say, Ralph, this is the same policies and practices that we must attack. We must awaken people to understand, as Cynthia McKinney says, American government has been hijacked. The people really have very little input into how it goes. So you must continue, we must all continue, to try to make people aware of these conditions. My own personal thing, I think it's in all of our interest. Please keep our political prisoners' spirits going by writing, and I'm not talking just about Lynn Stewart, although it is very personal to me, Mumia, Leonard, all political prisoners, Sekou here in New York. We all must continue our work, and I thank you and Maya very much for the work you do.
Thank you, Ralph.
Ralph, the address to reach Lynn.
Lynn Stewart, LynnStewart, 53504-054, MCC, 2 South, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 1007. If you put your return address, she will write back to you. Thank you so much.
We'll be with you again next week, and this time we hope you get to see Lynn.
And so do I, and thank you again.
Thank you, Ralph.
We return to The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 3, July 11th, 2009. DEPKA, the Israeli Intelligence Magazine, with an exclusive analysis titled, Afghanistan War is Unwinnable, Even with Boosted Coalition Strength. The NATO forces fighting in Afghanistan are unable to achieve the goals of the war, even with the additional U.S. combat troops promised this year, and the big jump in the size of Afghan security forces demanded by the U.S. commander, General Stanley McChrystal. DEPKA's military analysts see no real corroboration for the United Kingdom Chief of Defense Staff, Sir Jock Stirrup's assertion that the Taliban is, quote, losing in Afghanistan and, quote, real governance is emerging. As DEPKA notes, the Taliban have the advantage of not being dependent on outside supplies of food, water, or ammo, like the NATO forces. They have buried numerous secret bases hidden in local villages where they go to ground to strike at approaching American or British units, and when pressed, they melt into the population and become invisible. The American commanders of Strike the Sword are under orders to capture and to hold territory in Helmand province and strike up friendly relations with the local population. But no one in Helmand, Kabul, or even Washington can tell how long U.S. forces must or can hold on to these areas in order to win them away from the Taliban. Can they hang on in combat situations for 2 or 3 years? And DEPKA notes that the predicament applies to other Taliban strongholds in Afghanistan, especially in the east and south, where the Taliban is mounting successful attacks against the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, the ISAF, and the Afghan government. In the last 3 years, the Taliban has regained lost territory in key provinces such as Wardak near the capital Kabul and are close to retaking the southern town of Musakala.
My 160,000 U.S. soldiers and NATO soldiers will be in Afghanistan by July. 160,000 plus 150,000 contractors, which encompasses all of the mercenary and hired killer squads of XE or Backwater, not just electricians and construction people. 310,000 occupation forces in Afghanistan. I think the essential point that DEPKA has made here, and again, we have emphasized that this is the Mossad. This is the intelligence apparatus of the Israeli state, the Zionist apparatus itself. And it is essentially saying that there is no way to win a war like this, not merely because the Taliban have the capacity to fight, but because, above all, as DEPKA acknowledges, the Taliban are able to draw upon the population's hatred of the occupying army and of their determination to have rid of them, to drive them out. Taliban or not, the population wants the U.S. occupation to end and will collaborate with those who resist it and will not be a party to the continued presence of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. That is DEPKA's analysis, and that is DEPKA's conclusion.
Ralph, in September, the International Council on Security and Development released a map showing that the Taliban had a permanent presence, that was the term they used, in 80% of Afghanistan.
Well, Maya, I think we have to put this in its appropriate context. If we look at the articles of March of this year, notably March 11th, congressional Democrats back expanded war in Afghanistan. The United States House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly against the resolution to end the war in Afghanistan and begin withdrawal of U.S. troops. The roll call had 356 against, top heavy majorities of both Democrats and Republicans opposing an end to the war. House Democrats voted against the resolution 189-60. House Republicans voted against it 165-5. The leaders of both parties lined up together in unanimous opposition to the resolution, which would have invoked the 1973 War Powers Act. The measure had been abruptly and overwhelmingly repudiated by both parties, and moreover, the perfunctory debate and swift defeat of the resolution were a demonstration of what the World Socialist website appropriately calls the enormous gulf between the great mass of the American people and the representatives of big business who comprise the congressional delegations of both parties. For a majority of the American population opposes the war in Afghanistan and wants it ended now. Even a symbolic gesture in the direction of the mass anti-war sentiment had no support in Congress. The toothless character of the congressional opposition, an effective media blackout on the most tepid criticism of the escalating U.S. military operations in Afghanistan, expresses clearly who controls politics and the government of Barack Obama's administration. In fact, in a further article on March 27th, Obama administration pushes for more war funding. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appeared in Capitol Hill on March 25th to launch the Obama administration's drive to secure $40 billion in supplemental appropriations to fund the escalation of the Afghan war. The push for additional off-the-books funding for the current fiscal year comes as Congress was also debating the administration's proposed $159 billion to pay for the wars of occupation in Afghanistan and in Iraq through 2011. The request for the so-called base budget of the Pentagon, which covers military spending outside of the war costs, was $548.9 billion. In her opening remarks, Hillary Clinton was compelled to acknowledge the implications of the massive war spending, $322 billion on the books, not to mention the off-the-book spending of the current and next fiscal years, under conditions, of course, in which funding is cut for all vital social programs, deficits are soaring, and nothing is being done to create jobs for the 15 million unemployed.
Ralph, we have to consider the entire Pentagon and other agency budgets, the war budgets, and that comes to with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also troops throughout the world in Colombia, the Philippines, Africa, too. And that is $750 billion, more than $750 billion, $549 billion just for the regular Department of Defense appropriations. And as you say, the increase, the supplemental for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Maya, to put this in its appropriate context, Tom Engelhardt had a very instructive piece called U.S. Warfighting Numbers to Knock Your Socks Off. And Engelhardt writes that in his 1950s childhood, Ripley's Believe It or Not was part of everyday life. And then he mentions Mad Magazine's parody, which he called Rip-Up's Believe It or Don't. Well, here is his citation of what is the reality of the complete domination of capitalist production and financing by the Pentagon and military and imperial agenda. The Washington Post article, Lieutenant James H. Pillsbury, Deputy Commander of the U.S. Material Command, deeply involved in logistics operations, quote, "There are over 341 facilities, 263,000 soldiers, Defense Department civilians, contractor employees, 83,000 containers, 42,000 vehicles, 3 million equipment items, and $54 billion in assets just in Iraq alone." Now, the numbers are so extraordinary in demonstrating the complete dominion of military production and of Pentagon capital in the United States that 3.1 million items of equipment, 341 facilities, 10 megabases still operating through 2011. That's just Iraq. Armies once had baggage trains and camp followers. Our camp followers now help plant our military in foreign soil across the planet, build housing and defenses, supply it with vast quantities of food, water, fuel, and God knows what else, says Tom Engelhardt. But what's instructive here, brothers and sisters, is the following. I think we need to pay close attention to this. The Defense Logistics Agency sent 1.1 million hamburger patties to Afghanistan in the month of March, doubling the March 2009 figure. By the fall, the number of American troops will have tripled since President Obama took office. Hamburger patties, Obama has tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan. American deaths in Afghanistan under Obama have doubled in the first months of 2010. The number of wounded has tripled. The U.S. drone strikes have doubled, and they are on track to triple this year. And fuel deliveries to Afghanistan have doubled, rising from 15 million gallons a month to 27 million by this March. By the time a gallon of gas gets to U.S. troops, it costs over $100 a gallon. The private contractor KBR, holding a $38 billion contract to provide the U.S. military with, quote, a range of logistics services, has cost Washington $21 million in waste on truck maintenance alone, but its profits are vastly greater than when it started out under Bush and Cheney. The State Department has paid one private contractor alone, Triple Canopy, $438 million simply to guard the 104-acre U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the largest on the planet. That's more than half the price tag to build the embassy, the running of which is costing an estimated $1 billion in 2010. What is Barack Obama? What is his administration but instruments of imperial dominion, escalated death and massacre and slaughter and annihilation, not only of the people of Afghanistan?
Ralph, to go in further depth about the contractors, the Congressional Research Service, which is considered independent, bipartisan, reports on background information to the members of Congress, it produced a report on the contractors and particularly what it was going to mean in terms of President Obama's surge of over 30,000 U.S. troops into Afghanistan,
bringing them up to 150,000 soldiers, U.S. and NATO, in Afghanistan by July.
This surge of troops, according to the CRS, would be accompanied by a surge of up to 56,000 contractors, and that would bring the number of contractors in Afghanistan to 160,000. The Pentagon contracts out activities that previously were carried out by troops. This has been the privatization of the military, as we've discussed in early Taking AIM programs. Ralph.
Well, Maya, I want to point out that the effort to drive the Congress to vote for the huge escalation of funding for the wars in Afghanistan and beyond took place within a very specific context, namely the propaganda that was being presented in all the major newspapers, television, and media about the forthcoming campaign against the metropolis of Marja. Marja was the place where the great surge would be put into play and a firefight would defeat the Taliban in decisive fashion, preparing for the follow-up showdown in Kandahar. But Marja was the equivalent of Fallujah and then some, according to the propaganda that was being advanced at the time, and the entire rationale for the additional funding of billions beyond the already scheduled funding was based upon the preparation for the assault on Marja. At the time, the Congress was besieged with the reports from military spokespersons, and the media were replete with this propaganda.
And Ralph, I think we need to look at one reporter in particular, C.J. Chivers, who's the reporter for the New York Times. He's been a war reporter in Afghanistan. We rely on the reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the other major media. C.J. Chivers, his biography as listed in the New York Times, shows that from 1988 to 1995, he was an infantry officer in the U.S. Marine Corps serving in the Persian Gulf War. After that, he went to the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, but he's also graduated from several military schools, including the U.S. Army's Ranger Course. And you can see, if you watch his videos, particularly his video from Marja that is on the New York Times website, and I recommend you do, his perspective is quite clearly with the soldiers themselves and with the U.S. invasion.
Maya, C.J. Chivers operated inside police headquarters in Lower Manhattan at the time of 9/11. While in that bureau, he covered the attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th. He functioned as a special forces soldier and operative. He graduated from several of these military schools, including the United States Army Ranger program. So we're dealing here with a not just an embedded reporter, but an instrument of both police and military intelligence and a special forces person in their own right. And yet he is the lead figure in describing what purportedly is going on with respect to the combat in and around the metropolis of Marja. On April 19th, a first-hand look at firefights in Marja. He talks about the last Taliban-dominated population center in Helmand Province. Marines and several companies encountering something unusual in the American experience of the Afghan war, insurgent snipers. And he talks about competent and deliberate marksmen firing on Marine patrols. And he presents a firefight between the Marines of Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, the 6th Marines, and Taliban sharpshooters, by which he implies that you're dealing with people who are deliberate marksmen, who are specialized in targeting forces at distance as snipers. And he continues, over the years, there have been reports of well-trained Taliban marksmen in different parts of the country. But then, when you look closely at what he's describing, it becomes extremely revealing.
Ralph, this first-hand look at firefights in Marja is accompanied by video that was taken by C.J. Chivers, and I recommend everyone look at this video for what it shows Marja to actually look like and the overwhelming destruction that is wrought by U.S. forces. In this case, after the U.S. forces targeted with some blue smoke the compound from which they were being fired at by a couple of people with rifles, with bolt-action rifles, actually, who they called snipers, the U.S. sent in a plane to bomb that compound, and instead it bombed the compound next to it, killing the people living there, including many children.
Well, Maya, actually, what it struck was a compound maybe 100 yards or more away in which they slaughtered the civilian occupants. But when we look closely at the C.J. Chivers report, we learned something, as you were indicating, rather revealing. He starts by describing the so-called marksmen. How are they equipped? What are the weapons that these marksmen and these insurgents are using? An officer who gathered data from across Helmand Province offers insights. Among the rifles were two variants of the Lee-Enfield rifle, bolt-action rifles with design roots reaching to the late 19th century. One of the rifles was manufactured in the Long Branch Arsenal in Toronto. The other was manufactured by a government rifle factory in Ishapur, India, its date going back to the British occupation of India.
Ralph, we should mention that the Enfield rifles manufactured were done so in 1942.
Well, that, in fact, was the late production of the Lee-Enfield, whereas the Lee-Enfield rifle in question was a late 19th century model. Photographs of the Taliban, he writes, show that few of their gunmen carry old Mohsen Nagant bolt-action rifles of the Tsarist era. They were part of the Tsarist arsenal in the late 19th century.
The shooter loads these rifles manually by manipulating a bolt, that's why they're called bolt-action, that ejects the spent cartridge. And then the shooter would slide the next cartridge into place. That is, they have no automatic or semi-automatic features as opposed to the heavy-duty, rapid-fire machine guns that the U.S. forces use.
Third, the ammunition caches in Marja turned up Mark 7 British 303 cartridges that match Lee Enfield rifles. In two cases captured by Kylo Company, the British 303 cartridges dated to 1941. Many held bullets, he writes, that were jacketed in steel, which marked them as original British World War II production ammunition from Winston Churchill's time. The British used steel for bullet jackets to save copper and zinc for other wartime uses. A portion of the ammunition were older still, cartridges with round nose Mark VI rounds, which British forces were phasing out before the First World War, brothers and sisters. These so-called modern snipers are who? They are farmers, brothers and sisters. They are the peasants of Afghanistan, using rifles that date from the last century, the date from the Tsarist era, the date from the British occupation of India, bolt-action rifles, not automatic weapons, of the Second World War, dating back even to the First World War. What are we looking at here?
Ralph, I think this is the time to go to a clear look of Marja. Marja, the non-existent city the military said we conquered in Afghanistan, an insightful article by Gareth Porter from IPS News, posted on the internet on March 9, 2010. He writes, "For weeks, the United States public followed the biggest offensive of the Afghanistan war against what it was told was a, quote, city of 80,000 people, end quote, as well as the logistical hub of the Taliban in that part of Helmand. That idea was a central element in the overall impression built up in February that Marja was a major strategic objective, more important than other district centers in Helmand." And what Porter reveals is that Marja is not a city or even a real town, but a few clusters of farmers' homes amid a large agricultural area that covers much of the southern Helmand River Valley. And we should note that this large agricultural area is one of the major centers of opium production of poppies in Afghanistan.
Marja is not a city, he writes, or even a real town. It's a few clusters of farmers' homes. It's not urban at all. An official of the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, who asked not to be identified, admitted. The ISAF official said the only population numbering tens of thousands associated with Marja is spread across multiple villages and almost 200 square kilometers, or about 125 square miles. Marja has never even been incorporated. There are now plans to formalize its status as a district of Helmand Province. The official admitted that the confusion about Marja's population was facilitated by the fact that the name has been used for the large agricultural area where farmers gather for markets. In fact, the name Marja is more closely associated with a specific location where there is one mosque and a few shops. That very limited area was the nominal objective of Operation Mushtarak, to which 7,500 U.S. and North Atlantic Treaty Organization and Afghan troops were committed amid the most intense publicity given any battle since the beginning of the war.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 3. Ralph?
So, asked Porter, how did the fiction that Marja is a city of 80,000 get started? The idea was passed to the news media by United States Marines. The earliest reference in news stories to Marja as a city with a large population has a common origin in a briefing given on February 2nd by officials at Camp Leatherneck, the U.S. Marine base. The Associated Press then published an article the same day quoting, quote, Marine commanders state that the expected 400 to 1,000 insurgents are holed up in the southern Afghan town of 80,000 people. and their language, as Porter writes, evoked an image of house-to-house urban street fighting. In the same story, it stated, Marja is the largest town under Taliban control, and called it, quote, the linchpin of the militants' logistic and opium smuggling network, and it gave the figure of 125,000 for the population living in the town. ABC News followed with a story referring to the city of Marja, claiming that the city and the surrounding area are, quote, more heavily populated, urban and dense than other places the Marines have been able to clear and hold, unquote. The rest of the news media followed with images of a bustling, urbanized Marja and repeated stories using town and major city interchangeably. As Operation Mushtarak, which means together, began, U.S. military spokesmen were portraying Marja as a major urbanized population center. On February 14th, on the second day of the offensive, U.S. Marine spokesman Lieutenant Josh Didham stated the Marines were, quote, in the majority of the city at this point. He used language that conjured up images of house-to-house and urban fighting, referring to insurgents holding, quote, neighborhoods, unquote. A few days into the offensive, reporters began to refer to the region. One report referred to three markets in town covering 80 square miles. A town or city with an area of 80 square miles would be larger than Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, and Cleveland. The decision to hype Marja is the objective of Operation Mushtarak by planting the falsehood that it was a large-sized city would not have been made by the Marines of Camp Leavenworth. A central task of, quote, information operations, unquote, in the counterinsurgency wars, quote, is establishing the COIN, counterinsurgency narrative, according to Army Counterinsurgency Field Manual, revised in 2006 under General David Petraeus, the head of U.S. Central Command. The task is performed by, quote, higher headquarters. The COIN manual asserts that, quote, news media directly influenced the attitude of key agencies and political figures turned counterinsurgents, their operations, and the opposing insurgency. The manual refers to, quote, our war of perceptions conducted simultaneously and continuously using the news media, unquote. General Stanley McChrystal, commander of the ISAF, was preparing to wage such a war of perception in advance of the Marja operation. In remarks made just before the offensive, McChrystal, evoking the language of the counterinsurgency manual, stated, this is all a war of perception, quote unquote. And Maya, the Washington Post reported on February 22nd, that the decision to launch the offensive at Marja was, quote, intended to impress U.S. public opinion with the effectiveness of U.S. military in Afghanistan by showing a large and loud victory. As Gareth Porter concludes, the false impression that Marja was a significant city was an essential part of that propaganda.
That's right, Ralph. And soon after, President Obama, when he flew to Afghanistan, declared to the troops, quote, our troops have pushed the Taliban out of their stronghold in Marja. What is the actual truth? That appeared in an article by Richard Opel Jr. in the New York Times, April 3rd. Although the title is Violence Helps Taliban Undo Afghan Gains, the article is about what the U.S. is doing in Marja since this campaign. And that is pouring money in. $150,000 a week is doled out by one battalion outpost alone in Marja. This is in keeping with the political military strategy of the United States, which has been articulated as one, first clear the guerrillas, the so-called insurgents, from the populated areas, two, hold the areas with Afghan forces, although the Afghan forces themselves, the head of the Afghan forces, said it'll be at least 5 years before the Afghan forces can hold any areas, and three, build, so-called build, responsible governance and development to gain the loyalty of the population for the government in Kabul, the central government. But in this article of April 3rd by Richard Opel, we see, quote, Since their offensive here in February, the Marines have flooded Marja with hundreds of thousands of dollars a week. The tactic aims to win over wary residents by paying them compensation for property damage or putting to work men who would otherwise look to the Taliban for support. Just a few weeks since the start of the operation here, however, the Taliban have, quote, re-seized control and momentum in a lot of ways in northern Marja. Major James Kaufman, the civil affairs leader for the 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines, said in an interview, "We have to change tactics to get the locals back on our side." Colonel Gulham Shaki, an Afghan National Police commander there, said his informants have told him that at least 30 Taliban have come to one Marine outpost to take money from the Marines as compensation for property damage or family members killed during the operation in February. You shake hands with them and you don't know they're Taliban. Essentially, he's saying that the U.S. is funding the Taliban in Marja. Brigadier General Nicholson states, "We've got to reevaluate our definition of the enemy. Most people here, referring to Marja, identify themselves as Taliban." The original goal was to rid Afghanistan of the poppy fields. Afghanistan provides 90% of the opium worldwide. But they decided to abandon this policy of widespread eradication, particularly in Helmand province, because it would cost the farmers and the power brokers. After the February offensive, the Marines used cash payments instead to prod more than 20 store owners at one bazaar in northern Marja to open their doors. They thought this would stabilize the area. By late March, all but five shops had closed. Ralph?
Well, Maya, let us remind our listeners, brothers and sisters, C.J. Chivers, the reporter for the New York Times, for whom the public is dependent for information about the presumptive major battle of Marja, around which Obama and his administration trumpeted the significance of this population center and the battle for control of the southern region of Afghanistan that was centered upon it, on the basis of which the funding was pushed through Congress and this whipped-up hysteria about the need to back our troops just on the eve of a major battle was being presented, the big lie, brothers and sisters, by a gentleman who was, in fact, centered in police headquarters, intelligence functionary, at the time of what? September 11th, 2001.
Ralph, to return to the opium production in Helmand province, and particularly in Marja, again, New York Times, Rod Norland writing March 20th, U.S. turns a blind eye to opium in the Afghan town. The effort to win over Afghans on former Taliban turf in Marja has put American and NATO commanders in an unusual position of arguing against opium eradication. General Stanley McChrystal stated the military position, quote, U.S. forces no longer eradicate. Opium is the main livelihood of 60-70% of the farmers in Marja. Two-thirds of Marja's fields are now blooming with tall red poppies, and the forthcoming harvest would provide work for thousands of Afghans from outside the area because it's so labor-intensive, and as migrant laborers, they come into Marja to help pick the red poppies. Helmand produces more than half of Afghanistan's opium harvest, with 22% of its arable land devoted to poppies. Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opium. The opium trade, in one way or another, that is, the agricultural aspect, the planting of the poppies, the harvesting of the poppies, and then the concentration of the poppies into opium, that trade supports an estimated 1.4 million households in Afghanistan, which has a population of 25 to 30 million people. The Washington Post noted in 2007 in an article by Colm Lynch and Griff Witt that the opium trade in Afghanistan had hit a new peak and that Afghanistan was providing 93% heroin, morphine, and other opiates and also hashish on the world market, according to a report by the United Nations Anti-Drug Agency. In fact, in 2007, the opium production increased by 34% of the year prior to that. Ralph.
What are the politics of opium and heroin in Afghanistan, brothers and sisters? Afghanistan is essentially an agricultural country, and as such was entirely food self-sufficient. Wheat and other crops, although the area is arid, were serviced by complex irrigation systems derived from the snowfall from the Great Mountains. A rich and diverse agricultural production of a food self-sufficient country. Until when? Until the United States decided, through the ISI or the intelligence services in Pakistan, through the arming and financing of fundamentalist troops to destabilize Pakistan after the Soviet invasion, the United States decided to pin its hopes and to pin its funding upon the Northern Commander warlords, who were funded how? By the production of opium through poppies. Opium and poppy introduction in Afghanistan, a fruit of the Central Intelligence Agency and the fundamentalist campaign that it organized, funded, armed, and facilitated. In fact, the Taliban, inheriting this, maintained poppy production and then made the decision to eliminate it. They eradicated 90% of the poppy production in Afghanistan. They eliminated the heroin traffic in Afghanistan. And then what? The United States invaded, the United States bombed, the United States overthrew, and what happens then? Why, poppies are planted throughout Afghanistan. The opium production booms again. Imperialism, the destabilization of a country, the destruction of its agricultural self-sufficiency, the elimination of its native institutional life, its productive life. Imperialism imposes a heroin traffic from which it benefits in profits across the world. The mafia that maintains the essential production of heroin in Afghanistan controls almost 80% of the funding. The Taliban insurgency, which taxes the farmers, gets less than the farmers get. The overwhelming majority of the profits that arise from this vast engine of heroin in the world is the mafia that is controlled by the banking institutions of imperialism and of capitalism in the global scale.
Ralph, I mentioned that in 2007, the opium production had increased by 34%. In 2006, opium production accounted for one-third of the gross national product of Afghanistan. In 2007, according to the United Nations, it accounted for one-half the gross national product of Afghanistan. This is $64 billion, the export value of the opium. A quarter of that, actually less than a quarter, 21%, is earned by the farmers. The rest goes to the district officials, the Taliban who tax it, the warlords, and the drug traffickers. It's important to understand this. And the biggest centers are Helmand, which produces half of the opium trade. Now, let's look at the price. This is illicit, the illegal opium. In India, they grow what's called licit, that is legal opium that's used for narcotics that are prescribed to people. But 100% of the Afghan opiate is diverted for the illegal opium trade. And there's a reason for this. The illicit opium in 2000 price was $155 to $206 per kilo. But the licit, the legal opium from India, was garnering only $13 to $29 a kilo.
On April 25th, the New York Times carried the following story. Elite U.S. units step up effort in Afghan city before attack. Bands of elite American Special Operations Forces are operating with increased intensity for several weeks in Kandahar, southern Afghanistan's largest city, picking up or picking off insurgent leaders to weaken the Taliban in advance of major operations, senior administration and military officials stated. The looming battle, the New York Times states, for the spiritual home of the Taliban is shaping up as the pivotal test of President Obama's Afghanistan strategy, including how much the United States can count on the country's leaders and military for support, whether the increase in civilian casualties will compromise the strategy that depends on winning over the Afghan people. Following the first offensive into Marja, which showed mixed results, it will require the United States to navigate a battleground that is not only much larger than Marja, but militarily, politically, and culturally more complex. 2 months after the Marja offensive, officials acknowledged that the Taliban have retaken the momentum. Allied with the central government and its American backers, they are beating back locals. We are still waiting to see the outcome in Marja, says Shahida Abdali, the deputy Afghan national security advisor. And the battle for Kandahar, the New York Times states, is the make-or-break offensive of the 8.5-year war. The question is whether military force can overcome a culture built on distrust of outsiders and hatred for foreign forces. In today's date, the World Socialist website carries the following story. U.S. military escalates its dirty war in Afghanistan. American Special Forces units are operating throughout Kandahar and its surroundings, assassinating alleged leaders, militants of the resistance. Sinister and murderous character, the New York Times has acknowledged, opening salvos of the offensive carried out in the shadows. Elite units, boasting about the large numbers of insurgents in and around Kandahar that are being captured and killed and eliminated. The New York Times reported, says the World Socialist website, that a dozen military and civilian officials are directly involved in the Kandahar offensive and have agreed to speak about special force activities in order to, quote, scare off insurgents. Of course, this is absurd. The Taliban do not require articles in the New York Times to inform them that, quote, large numbers of the population in the Kandahar area are being killed, captured, or crushed by tanks and other machinery. As the articles point out, what we're in the presence of is a murder apparatus, an assassination apparatus, a special forces apparatus, an indiscriminate slaughter of any population figure who is known to oppose the occupation or to resist it, labeling them Taliban and killing them in their shoes and in their homes.
The strategy, this is General Stanley McChrystal's strategy, is to first send in his special operations troops. Then in June and July, before Ramadan sets in August, during those 2 months when the weather is most amenable to warfare, McChrystal is going to send in the bulk of his troops, which will be 12,000 U.S., British, and Canadian troops supported by 10,000 Afghan government soldiers and police, and we don't know how many private contractors go in as support troops for that to make a large force. But this large force should not be enough for a city between 800,000 and 900,000 people. What we have in Afghanistan is a shift to the urban centers, and the urban center being Kandahar and Kabul having been supposedly secured and maintained by the Afghan troops. Throughout Afghanistan, the U.S. has been pulling back. April 14th, Elisa Rubin, writing with the support of C.J. Chivers from Karangal Outpost in Afghanistan. U.S. forces closed the post in the Afghan, quote, Valley of Death. It's called the Valley of Death because over the years there have been so many U.S. soldiers slaughtered. It's the third area in eastern Afghanistan where the outposts and what they call bases have been closed. And it's important to look at the Karangal Valley because this is really descriptive of how the U.S. has been functioning in Afghanistan. McChrystal has said that he's going to consolidate and refocus his forces. where they might change the momentum of what has been a losing contest. The fighting for the isolated mountain valleys like Corangal, even if they are hideouts supposedly for clusters of Taliban, is no longer sustainable, according to McChrystal. Ralph.
Well, Maya, at war, Notes from the Front Lines, Elisa Rubin and C.J. Chivers acknowledge the following. By the time you read this, the soldiers who lived on the mountain base known as the Corangal Outpost will have left, taking their equipment, the generators, and fuel. A place iconic for its breathtaking beauty, the outpost was at times during its 4 years in existence the deadliest place in Afghanistan for Americans. In some ways, the place was a memorial to the men who died there. And what does the article disclose? That the United States soldiers and their special forces were defeated in this remote Corangal Valley, that after years of terrorizing the population with overwhelming firepower, they have left because they were defeated. The Corangal, a narrow valley just 6 miles long, the mountains rise up above it a couple of thousand feet, the houses are built into the hillsides, terrace like the fields. Look at this, said Lieutenant Colonel Bryan, who commands Task Force Lethal Warriors, who has responsibility for the Corangal. Look at this. It makes it so sad that we have to leave. The Special Operations Force, who accompanied a group on a walk outside the satellite base, scanned the ground constantly with binoculars. The Taliban and the population are like ghosts in the night. The outpost itself was a sliver of mountainside, and the deadly drama played out on a ribbon of land along the river and in the operation posts above. Attacks were happening constantly. In fact, the U.S. had to acknowledge it was defeated. Quote, you're not going to win their hearts and minds. We tried to bring them a civilized situation, stopping insurgents from reaching more populated areas. The whole point of counterinsurgency is that you secure the local population and legitimize your presence, said Major Fussell. But the thing about the Corangal and Waigai Valleys is they don't recognize us. When you go to them and say we want to secure you, they say we don't want you.
Ralph, the Corangalese speak a language unrelated to Pashto or Dari, which are the two main Afghan tongues. It's been an isolated community throughout its history. It's basically a community that supported itself from cutting down the cedar trees. However, the first thing the United States did when it entered the Corangal outpost, which, by the way, did not have a Taliban presence prior to the U.S. forces being there, the first thing that the U.S. did was to close down the only productive place in the Corangal area, and that's the sawmill. They took over the sawmill to create their outpost. Thus, the people of the area had no work.
While we are reading the reports about the U.S. withdrawal and defeat in Corangal, Jason Ditz reports on April 25th, another of the night raids that General Stanley McChrystal has repeatedly promised to curb has gone awry and sparked violent protests across the Lungar province of Afghanistan after it was revealed that civilians were killed in raids across the region. In fact, what happened is that the population mobilized. They blocked the roads, they turned on NATO supply trucks, and they torched and burnt 15 U.S. supply trucks while the crowd threw firebombs and stones and whatever was in their hands and grenades at the trucks and at the soldiers. And indeed, Maya, I want to point out that on May 16, 2009, an important story by Seymour Hersh revealed that Barack Obama has tapped Cheney's assassination team boss to run the Afghan war. The Pulitzer Prize-winning American investigative journalist stated that a special unit called the Joint Special Operations Command under Stanley McChrystal was part of an assassination unit that had been run by Vice President Dick Cheney. McChrystal has become Obama's man running his operation in Afghanistan. Triple the number of soldiers, multiply the number of dead, and the operations of murder are resulting in what? A hatred of the population, a certain defeat for the United States, and a bleeding of the population at home no less than those abroad.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 3. It will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.